You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We are a global NGO with research experts in 23 different countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. In our podcasts, we will outline and interrogate the latest issues related to business and human rights, bringing together diverse expertise from frontline activists, civil society, companies, investors, and academia. In this series, we are partnering with the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights to mark the 10th anniversary of the UN Guiding Principles and look forward to what the next decade might hold. Over the course of four episodes, we will examine the impact and reach of the UNGPs since they were introduced through a different thematic lens each week. We'll explore the impact, gaps, and opportunities as we look forward to the next 10 years.
Welcome to our podcast of Gender, Discrimination, and the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. My name is Golda Benjamin. I'm Program Director at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. And I'm joined here today by Ananya Bhattacharjee, International Coordinator of the Asia Floor Wage Alliance, an international campaign for collective industrial bargaining in the global garment industry. Professor Surya Deva, Vice Chair of the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights, and Kayla Winarski-Green, Human Rights and Business Advisor with the Danish Institute for Human Rights. Thank you all for joining me today. The UN Guiding Principles, or the UNGPs, provide a globally agreed-upon standard and framework for states and companies to prevent, address, and remedy business-linked human rights abuses, gender discrimination, and intersecting structures of marginalization mean women and girls experience unique and disproportionate business-related human rights abuses. Recent work on the UNGPs acknowledged the structural gender barriers at play, but we recognize that much still needs to be done by governments and businesses towards translating policies into practices that protect and advance the right of women and girls. In this episode, we'll be discussing how business operations both perpetuate and exacerbate gender discrimination. We'll also examine whether the UNGP framework has been a useful tool to address the challenges. Then, of course, we will look to the next 10 years and the challenges and opportunities ahead. So, I'd like to start by thinking about the story so far. Surya, during your time as a member of the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights, you have led the group's work on gender. Could you tell us about the role of states and business in addressing business-related human rights issues and why a gender lens is so crucial? And what are some of the progress and limitations you've seen over the past 10 years?
Thank you very much, Golda, for inviting me to join this podcast. Whenever states or businesses are expected to implement the UN Guiding Principles, it is absolutely vital that they integrate a gender perspective into whatever they do. Because unless they do that, they cannot adequately implement UN Guiding Principles. Let us take businesses as part of Pillar 2 as an example. Businesses need to conduct human rights due diligence to identify, prevent, mitigate, and remediate adverse impacts. Now, if they do not consider that the impact on men and women could be different, even amongst women, the impact could be different on different women, then they will not be able to identify or prevent those adverse impacts, right? So whether we are talking about women in supply chains, or we are looking at human rights defenders, or we are looking at even issues like climate change, the impact on women is very, very different. And that's where I think adopting a gender framework or a gender lens is absolutely critical. In terms of the progress, I think we have now the gender guidance and the gender framework, which the UN Working Group released in 2019. And because of that, I think there are more actors, governments, businesses, trade unions, civil society organizations, and also the international institutions, they're more aware of adopting a gender perspective So I would say the issue has become a mainstream issue in the business and human rights field. That is definitely progress. At the same time, I see that the structures of discrimination, the patriarchal norms and bias that we have in society, they are hard to dismantle in a short period of time. And I think those structures of inequality and discrimination, the patriarchal values, they continue because the governments, businesses, they're operating part of society. I think that will take a little longer to dismantle those.
Thank you, Surya. And it is indeed very critical, your observation on the fact that a single action could impact people differently depending on whether or not they're male or female, and even among women themselves. And so this is a good segue for me to turn the microphone over to Ananya, because your work, Ananya, has always been very inspiring to me, and it's because your work is closely linked to the gendered impacts of business-related human rights abuse. And you have a great deal of experience navigating the barriers for women seeking remedy for abuse. So in your experience and, you know, looking back, how has the UNGP model of responsibility for states and businesses affected the global garment industry? And have you seen examples of positive change or even limitations to this framework?
I agree with Surya that certainly there is a greater awareness of the gender aspect of industry, and in particular global industry. I work mainly in the global garment industry, which is a low-wage industry that hires mostly women workers. So in the context of that industry, what I have seen is that the UNGP principles have a great discursive value and power, which by which I mean to say is that they have set a framework of discourse, a framework which is rights-based, that should form, that should help us guide towards ending gender discrimination. However, the weakness that I see so far is that it is largely at the level of discursive change that it has had its impact. And benefits that come out of discursive change can really last only so long when you have low-wage women workers suffering daily from gender-based violence and harassment. Certainly in the last 10 years, we have seen progress. We have seen the inclusion of the guiding principles in several other instruments. We have seen due diligence and responsibility be much more clearly articulated over the years in different platforms, in different instruments. And we definitely see much more clear articulation of responsibility, by which I mean that in the global supply chain, where multinational companies, like in the fashion industry, the global brands, are the drivers of the global supply chain, and their responsibility is fixed. And there are certain criteria that are considered good to follow, such as, you know, be collaborative, cost sharing. If the environment locally is weak or the laws are weak, then in the global supply chain, brands are supposed to make up, compensate for those weaknesses and stick to international standards and norms, regardless of local weaknesses. So these are all good ideas, good principles that I think we have a lot of consensus on. However, as I work on the ground, I see very little change. And this is because at a fundamental level, all these principles are still voluntary. So there is a lack of enforcement, regulation, and the general non-binding nature. It also does not help to build the power of women workers on the ground. Because how do women workers build power? It is when they have a mechanism that is accountable, that is trustworthy, that is predictable. And these are only possible when something has relatively high bar of regulation, enforceability, and a bindingness. And so what we are all seeing during the pandemic is a global supply chain which has already been imbalanced, be further act out of balance. And really, there is no counterbalancing force to it, which would be the force of workers coming together, collective power, union power, women workers' power. That counterbalance force is missing. And partly it is missing because of the gender discrimination, the violence and the harassment that continues on a daily basis to ravage women workers' lives. So just to summarize, at a discursive level and as at the level of principle setting, it has been a success. However, we need to move to an area of regulation, enforceability, bindingness, which then helps build power of women workers on the ground.
You used a very accurate term, Ananya, and that's that the UNGP has discursive value and impact. And I think it is our responsibility in this conversation today to open the box of reality as well. And so it would be good to hear more about the specific context that you're working in, the threats to women as a result of business operations, and what specific impacts are for those affected. And I'm looking at you, Kayla, because you have looked into corporate abuse during the pandemic, specifically at the experience of garment workers and also mothers. Can you draw out the particular impact the pandemic has had on these women? What protections were lacking which allowed the abuse to also flourish, especially during this extremely difficult moment in our collective history?
I would say that the pandemic both exacerbated impacts and vulnerabilities that already existed by stretching and stripping social protections, and also created new ones due to its specific and novel nature. So for example, in my research into the impacts on single working mothers, I focused on the United States, which is not only my home country, but also has the world's highest rate of children living in single parent households, the majority of which are women led, and a low rate of burden sharing with extended family members. And I found what we called a perfect storm. It was characterized by schools and daycares being closed, forcing women to add full-time childcare onto their existing work, combined with low-wage jobs, which are unlikely to allow employees to work from home, and the fact that women are disproportionately represented in fields that will expose them to the pandemic. For example, we saw a very high rate of women in care work, which meant that women faced job insecurity, financial instability, and higher risks of contagion and a lack of personal protective equipment while they were balancing work and childcare with little to no support. And of course, this needs to be viewed from an intersectional lens. So we saw women from minority and POC communities facing additional obstacles due to overlapping systems of oppression. And while my blog post and research on this for the Business and Human Rights Resource Center and Open Global Rights focused on the U.S. country context, I know that similar issues have also been faced in other country contexts, including the Global South. In terms of the research I did on garment workers, of course, I'm parroting what we had already heard from an expert, but we had seen the pandemic referred to as an existential crisis for the garment industry, which led to the wholesale closure of thousands of garment factories with millions of workers who, of course, as Ananya noted, are often low wage and predominantly women being laid off with no social safety net and instances of suppliers not being paid. I would caveat that the responses from global brands have really run the gamut. So there were instances of companies agreeing to pay for work done, but we really were sort of shocked by all of the instances of this not occurring. And of course, even in the worst case scenario, the Business and Human Rights Research Center found over 2 million mostly women garment workers losing their jobs or being furloughed without pay or severance. This leading to thousands of workers staging protests, of course, as Ananya noted, due to the lack of protections and unionizations, and these protests would create the risk of infection. And even when workers were able to come in, they noted lack of adequate protections, which left them and their families and their communities at the risk of infection. So this was also another instance of a perfect storm, as the predominantly female garment workers would either face devastating impacts when they were being furloughed and their wages weren't paid, or when they were able to go into work and lacking adequate social protection.
Kayla, you mentioned overlapping structures of exploitation. And a while ago, Ananya also relayed to us, and you started talking, Ananya, about this brand's continuous refusal to also look at where their responsibility lies in the entire system and in the entire community of pain with what's happening during the pandemic. And so we turn our eye towards the global garment industry because it really presents a huge example of how business operations can affect, interact, and sometimes even capitalize on structures of gender discrimination, or what Kayla referred to as overlapping structures of exploitation. Ananya, how does gender discrimination play into the issues of supply chain abuse in sectors like the global garment industry?
The way we look at the garment industry is that, why is it an important industry? It is a very important industry for developing countries because it is seen as the pathway for industrialization. It's basically new workers entering the industrial workforce, of which women are the majority of the new entrants. And this development pathway is supposed to lead to some decent jobs for workers who are displaced from other agriculture and other forms of industry. However, what we see is that fashion brands use this pathway and the vulnerabilities in this pathway in a way to leverage what we would say is supersized profits. We are not against profits, but they leverage it for supersized profits. And so it's a business model that actually relies on a low-wage, vulnerable workforce, namely women workers and other forms of social marginalization. So it's a business model that is based on low-wage, vulnerable workforce. And in the case of women, what we see is what we call gendered industrial relations, by which we mean to say is that gender-based violence in the garment industry is not a one-off thing. It's not like, okay, an assault took place there or a harassment took place some other day. These are not incidents. We see them as part of the structure of industrial relations that are necessary to sustain this business model, which pushes maximum profits, superlative profits, to brands. Now, as Kayla was saying, these were pre-existing weaknesses in the global supply chain structure, where instead of collaboration, which is what, you know, guiding United Nations guiding principles and other international principles promote, it is really a structure where brands act not collaboratively at all, but unilaterally, and use the pre-existing weaknesses to leverage their sustainability during the pandemic. This is what brands have done. This ends up having a cascading effect down to suppliers, who then pass on the cost to workers. So basically, we see a lot of brands have really stabilized their profits, and this is because they've passed on the cost to women workers, and the cost of the liability to suppliers, the liability for compliance. So during the pandemic, we see a really stark reality where use of gender disparities have been systematically used. We have, and Asia Floor Wage Alliance is releasing a report on July 7th precisely on this. And we have found that women workers dominate weak employment relationships, be it casual workers or contract workers. There is a pay gap between men and women. And this has been used in the industry opportunistically. So when costs need to be cut, the weak employment relationships of women are used to throw them out. Another way is to keep women on the job because they earn less, their wages are less, but then they're asked to work much higher hours, much higher targets, and not even paid for all the overtime. We have seen pregnant women be fired and not taken back. We have seen women go into the enormous amount of debt over the during the pandemic. And these, as Kayla has said, they are often the heads of their households. And we have seen an intensification of work because the domestic and the work sphere have both become incredibly stressful for women workers. So basically, I think what I'm trying to say is that gender-based violence and harassment is part of the business model. It's not a side product. It is ingrained in the industrial relations necessary to run the business. And the pre-existing, pre-pandemic conditions that existed, the vulnerabilities that existed, were then unilaterally used during the pandemic by brands to stabilize their business. And we see absolutely a disproportionate impact on women workers due to loss of employment, loss of wages, increase in precarity, forced labor. We are talking about women workers who have sold their kitchen utensils to pay for food next day. So this is, it's an incredibly tragic situation that women workers are facing during the pandemic. But it's not new. It is based on leveraging pre-pandemic weaknesses.
Ananya, you very rightfully exposed structural problems that affect women and girls in the workplace. And your narration of their realities is both deep and painful. And in these kinds of conversation, and that's exactly the value of the UN Guiding Principles, one of its many values is to open up these conversations so that we can also answer difficult questions about moving ahead. And so really, it has been 10 years since the beginning of the UN Guiding Principles. And much discussion has been given in recent months about taking stock, assessing the benefits and limitations of the framework so far. And so as we now look ahead to the next decade of human rights in business, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what needs to be done to better integrate a gender perspective in efforts to address business-related abuse. Surya, what are some of the key areas of work you've identified? And I've always appreciated, Surya, both your optimism and your pessimism when we talk about opportunities and challenges about our work.
Thanks, Golda. Going forward, I would really like that a gender perspective is treated as a cross-cutting issue. We led this project of the working group. We provided the guidance and developed a framework. But I think we have to see this as an issue that has to be integrated in whatever we do in the business and human rights domain. Let me connect it with what Ananya was saying earlier about voluntariness of the UN guiding principles on the ground, little impact, and the imbalance of power that we see in the garment sector or in other sectors, that imbalance continues. So how can we change this? And I would say there is a lot of discussion about mandatory human rights due diligence, especially in Europe. My question is, that to what extent those policymakers or lawmakers are engaging with the Global South? To what extent they are talking to women workers in the Global South supply chains? Because you are enacting this piece of legislation in Europe, which is going to benefit directly some of these workers in the Global South, right? So we need to integrate a gender perspective and have a better conversation with them. Same will apply to other issues, whether this is about climate change or issues about access to remedy, because women face unique and additional challenges in seeking access to remedy, whether this is against sexual harassment or this is termination of employment because of pregnancy-related reasons, you know. So those are unique situations. So access to remedy, again, we need a gender perspective. Or going forward, we're talking about automation. Ananya has highlighted that most of the workers in the garment sector are women workers. But if these brands are going to introduce automation in the garment sector, who will suffer more? 80% of the workers are women, so they will lose their jobs. So I think those are the issues that I would really like to be integrated, gender perspective to be integrated in everything we do. Rather, we consider gender as a separate compartment and we discuss this, right? I think it would also be useful, Golda, going forward, that if other organizations can develop more specific guidance on what needs to be done by businesses and how to do it. Working group, of course, provided generic guidance. But I think there can be sector-specific challenges, which can be different, let us say, in the garment sector as compared to the investment in the banking sector. Or the extractives may face different issues. Extractives, in a way, is the complete reverse, where women are not represented in the workforce, right? So I think we need more guidance. And my last point for now is that we need to develop and support more SMEs going forward and the actors in the informal economy. And again, that goes back to the point which Ananya was saying, that there are more women workers in the SMEs and informal economy. So I think we need to support them. So we can't talk about gender issues only in the context of the big multinationals and their supply chains. We also need to look at the small players. And sometimes we need to promote women bottom up in terms of the entrepreneurship on the part of women so that they can start working. So I think these are the issues that I would really like to change going forward in the next decade or beyond, Golda.
Very important observation, Surya, on integration. And also very important that you noted that when we talk about gender issues, we have to look at, for example, industries where women are a majority of the population or the workforce, and more importantly, also in industries where women are virtually invisible because of several factors. And I think integration is one of the things that we should look at both as a challenge and as an opportunity. So I'd like to ask you, Kayla, where do you think the challenges and opportunities lie for the next 10 years? It's always difficult to look 10 years ahead, especially because we're going through a very difficult moment. But let's plan ahead because it's the only way we can survive this. And what markers of progress would you like to see when we talk about the gender lens and gender issues?
First of all, in terms of challenges, I would note, as both Ananya and Surya have mentioned, that gender impacts don't exist in a vacuum. So many of the challenges that we face as a society, from political polarization to gun violence to, as Surya mentioned, climate change, all have their own specific gendered impacts. At the same time, through our work at the Danish Institute, we've noted that when working on the subject of gender and business and human rights, certain challenges do need to be addressed. For example, how women are included in national action plans processes and how such plans address the topic of gender does warrant further discussions. We've also noted that important societal developments, such as the energy transition, so moving away from these fossil fuels that we just discussed, and the digital transition, cause and contribute to specific gendered impacts, which need to be addressed going forward if these developments are supposed to take place in a way that contributes to achieving substantive gender equality. We've also noted that how specific business and economic models benefit from and perpetuate structural gender discrimination is also important to examine. And it's a challenge that gender is often left out of human rights and business discussions, and there seems to be a disconnect between all the work that's already been done on women's rights, LGBTI rights, and intersectionality, and business and human rights frameworks and practices. So putting together these broader conversations, there are many connections to be made, and there's a wealth of knowledge that the business and human rights community could really tap into if we're able to address both at the same time. But in terms of benefits, from a more optimistic perspective, we're also seeing increased scrutiny from investors and from the global community on gendered impacts associated with business activities. And if I can circle back to the pandemic, the subject still on everybody's mind, the lessons learned from how business and human rights stakeholders, which does include companies, are reacting now will be illustrative in how to behave in a post-pandemic reality. And I think the fact that we're having this conversation right now is indicative of future opportunities ahead. In terms of markers of progress, I would like to see these lessons learned at the forefront of attention from business and human rights stakeholders and making sure that it's integrated into corporate behavior. And I think the most important is that it's very critical that business and human rights stakeholders work towards a substantive gender equality as expected by international human rights law and are setting regulatory expectations, exercising due diligence, and as we've all mentioned, ensuring access to remedy.
Listening to you, Kayla, reminds me of one of my favorite mantras when talking about changes and our fight for reforms. And there's always this narration that if you want women and girls to be part of the conversation, give them a seat at the table. And when the seat does not exist, allow them to create a seat at the table. And more importantly, when the table's conversations is far too difficult for them, let them create a new table so that they can change the story and invite all the other stakeholders to participate. And so as we start to wrap up, I really want to hear any final thoughts you all have. And perhaps one key takeaway from this discussion for our listeners is this. What do you think is going to be crucial to the integration of gender in business respect for human rights? Ananya, I'd like to start with you.
Actually, I agree with what Surya said, that gender is not a compartment that one builds. It's not like a sub-department of a broader discussion. It has to be cross-cutting and integrated into the entire framework. Now, right now, what I see is what is good for women is what is good for the planet. Right now, due to the pandemic, we are seeing definitely a heightened sensitivity about issues of environmental crisis, of health, of safety, of overconsumption, because fast fashion is all about overproduction and overconsumption, which then leads to not just workers going into debt, but simply even middle-class consumers in Europe and United States going into debt by just having to keep on buying, getting addicted to the advertising and the push to consume. So what we are looking at is really the need for a transformed industry. An industry where profits are absolutely, you know, that is allowable. That is part of business. But the way the super-sized profits that are going on right now at the detriment of basic human rights, I think this is becoming intolerable to the general public. We are also seeing a broader discussion on tax havens, and so on. So my view is that what is good for women is good for the world. And we have seen that when the environment is damaged, when workers do not get living wage, when they face violence, we are seeing a breakup, not just in an individual worker's life, but in society, but the way the planet works, where you have an excessive violence, lack of harmony, and lack of basic human necessities being met. So that transformation is key at this point. The second piece I would like to mention is that at this point, the way fashion brands are trying to solve the gender-based violence and harassment at the workplace in their factories is by very top-down measures. You know, let's just do these trainings, you know, bring in a bunch of managers and random workers and get them trained. We are all for trainings, but we feel that we need to complement top-down processes with bottom-up processes. So Asia Floorwich Alliance has a safe circle strategy which is about the bottom-up building up of women's voices so that the structures that are laid at the top actually work, because they don't work currently. So there is a complementarity that is needed between bottom-up and top-down. The third point I would like to say is that right now we are living at a time where it is really up to the goodwill and voluntary nature of the brands to stick to these principles. What we need are enforcement mechanisms which are binding, which are enforceable, which have a strong regulatory power, and that workers can use at the grassroots level. So these are the three ways that I feel things should change.
Ananya speaks of transformation shaped by the voices and rights of women. Surya, what do you think is crucial in the years to come?
I'll make a couple of points, Golda, but I also liked your idea of seat on the table or creating a new table. And I would like to add a footnote to that, because there is always a danger that a seat is given on the table, but the power is not there. It is a symbolic seat. And I think I would like to say that it is a real seat with real powers on the table. Rather, it is not a tick box. Because I see a real push that sometimes there could be this tick box or tokenism attitude or approach, right? We need to move away from this, and that is my first point, and create what I would call a substantive equality model. Women are not asking for charity. This is their right. This is the basic issue of equality. And in many cases, men, and in some cases even women, could be part of the problem of creating this inequality. Now they have to become part of the solution going forward. And I think that's where raising awareness at all stages, inside family, in schools, in universities, as part of trade unions, because trade unions could be very patriarchal institutions, right? They may not protect enough the rights of the women workers. So I think we need this transformation going forward. And my last point is that we need to provide opportunities to women to become leaders. That is crucial. It is not that they are the passive recipient of this empowerment from us, that we are giving it to them. No, they must have the voice and all the opportunities so they can decide what they want and they can share this power in society equally.
Surya, you know, I always appreciate when people use the word power in relation to conversations about women, because it is important. And us as the Resource Center, one of the main things that we dream of is for women to claim power so that they're able to chart their own destiny. And so I'd like to ask the same question also for Kayla. What do you think is crucial for the years to come?
So, of course, I'm completely aligned with what's been said so far. I would add that focusing specifically on corporate actors, these considerations must be mainstreamed throughout businesses' efforts to respect human rights, rather than being treated as a single issue or an add-on or, as Surya mentioned, a tick box exercise. Fundamental is this understanding that women's rights are human rights, and virtually every issue or category of issues, labor, environment, community, can have a unique impact on women. So respect and gender considerations, which again must be focused on from this completely intersectional approach, must be considered throughout businesses' efforts and activities in order for substantive gender equality to be achieved as consistent with international human rights law.
Thank you, Kayla, Ananya, and Surya. We truly appreciate your generosity and your wisdom throughout this conversation. And today, we really have only just begun to scratch the surface of these issues. The landscape of business and human rights will continue to evolve over the next 10 years, and new challenges will rise. And the way that we use a gender lens to examine and address these impacts will continue to take shape. Ananya Bhattacharjee, Surya Deva, Kayla Winarski-Green, thank you so much for participating and for your rich contributions to our discussion. We look forward to continuing to work together to put respect for human rights at the heart of business operations.
Thank you for listening to This Way Up from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at BHRRC and let us know what you think. Please keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share on your networks.